C2A. Number 2A.
We started yesterday by trying to catch the tone that goes right through the chapter of Tome and Eucharist, because we have seen in scientific text interpretation, we do not start right with single sentences and follow from one single sentence to the other, but that we first must know the tone of the whole, so that then afterwards we really can see every sentence and every statement within the characteristics of the whole. So atonement has shown us that atonement is exemplifying man's unity with God. So it is not just a mental activity, but it is actually a exemplification, showing forth by example what we entertain in consciousness. And this atonement with God is in the direction of man to God and not God to man, which says God does not have to reconcile himself with man nor to atone with man, but it is man's attitude that must be changed, that we submit ourselves to the divine decree. So that there is that line, that direction of man atoning with God to the point that man is at one mind, at one mind with God. That excludes the attempt to atone truth and error. Error and truth are irreconcilable. Just as science is irreconcilable with any goofy sense of science, peace, peace, where there is no peace, is no true reconciliation. It means that truth does never reconcile itself with error. What is therefore necessary in atonement is that we find our at-one-ment with truth, which is science. So this is an activity and an action that has to be fulfilled by each one of us. There is no vicarious salvation, so that somebody else through his work, like Jesus or the practitioner or a friend or somebody else, is going to do the job for us. Each one has to do that and undertake that work. Then we have seen under the caption of the divine and the human that actually the work has to be done through the Christ and not through human will, not through human efforts, but through our oneness with Christ, and let Christ do the job. The divinity of Christ, we have seen there, must be manifest in the humanity of man. It's the divinity of the Christ. Therefore, let Christ fulfill the job, that Christ must really be that which motivates us, so that human will, personal desires, personal and human efforts are out, and what must be governing within us, that what should animate us, is actually the Christ idea. We must reflect divine truth, life, and love. So that we give really to God the power in the messianic work and never deviate from that and always have that attitude, if God doesn't do it, we can't do it either. Let God do it. That's what God can do, that we should not try to do ourselves and play God. So that we have seen that the divine, the Christ demand, that the divine must overcome the human at every point. And we feel that we are in for a great adventure in this second chapter, where we really have to prove ourselves by letting really the divine constantly overcome the human, where there is a great struggle going on, a divine and a holy warfare going on, where we say we can only advance and we can only go further if all that which is not of the nature of God, which is contrary to the nature of God, is first being overcome within ourselves. This indicates very clearly that science is not the path of roses, that we are not just swinging and singing and harping into heaven, but that it is a real tough way to go, and that we really find, so to say, the joy to overcome that which is not God-like within us. That should not be a heavy burden to get rid of the God unlike in us, but that it should be a well rejoicing, that it should be a Eucharist, a spiritual Eucharist. We says there is nothing more beautiful than to take the bull by the horn and really subdue everything within us that does not belong to the divine. So that's Paul's sense. We rejoice in tribulation, so that the divine must overcome the human at every point. And that is where we left the subject yesterday. And we go on with our study material on page 2, where we have now another group of subject that can be subsumized under the term the way, that Atonement and Eucharist shows the way. And in there we have points 13 to 17, and I just go along those points quickly to fortify within our consciousness what this Atonement and Eucharist demands of us. We have first that Christ is the way, so that not actually Jesus is the way, but that the Christ is the way, and that we have to see that very clearly. Which includes that, therefore, Jesus, who is not the way, is the way shower. That's different. The way is the Christ. And naturally, when Jesus conceived of him as a Christ, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. But Jesus himself, seen humanly, presents to us really the way shower, showing how we can go the way of the Christ. Here, Mrs. Eddy brings in many, many references, which I just want quickly to read out or to point out, always in the sense that as you have this reference in the study note, that you don't need to take many notes, but that you get the tonality of it, the impact of it. But Mrs. Eddy says that Jesus taught the way of life by demonstration. He did not just say you have to go along the way, but also you have to demonstrate the way step by step. Jesus pointed out the way of truth and love. Now, why was Jesus the way for us? Why is he the way for mortals? Because he himself partook of the mortal nature to a great extent. Not perhaps to that great extent, not perhaps it's a false term, not to that great extent as we partake of it, because Jesus was partly really partaking of a spiritual conception, but on the other part he partook of an ordinary human birth, mortal earthly birth. Therefore she speaks about Jesus in that dual nature of spiritual and material, and he says that Jesus' birth partook, birth, not conception, partook partly of Mary's earthly condition. Just as we partake of the earthly condition in birth, so did Jesus. She says that Jesus was endowed on the one side with the Christ, the divine spirit, without measure. So that's one side of him. He was endowed with the Christ, spirit without measure, showing that we too can be endowed with the spirit, that we have access to God's spirit and have access to the spiritual realm, and therefore also to the idea of man as being purely spiritual. But because he partook on both of earthly condition and endowed with the spirit, this naturally points out a duality, an opposition, a mixing of spirit and matter, which he too had to solve. He had to work out that duality within himself. That's why Mrs. Edison says this accounts for his struggles. So we must not forget that Jesus himself also had to struggle. He had to work out really the whole problem of life, how to get out of the earthly condition of Mary's birth and his material structure, and how to lay down a sense that man is partly spiritual, partly material. This accounted also for his struggles, and this enabled him, this is now the result of it, what he wants to bring out, that this enabled him to be the mediator or way shower between God and men. So if he had partaken of a holy spiritual conception and also of a holy spiritual birth, there would have been no duality. Jesus would not have appeared on this earth, because it would not have been perceptible to the five physical senses. So we must see that this is a very different a condition at the time of Jesus than it is in today in the apocalypse. At the time of Jesus, Jesus was representing the Christ in its dual nature of earthly conditions and the spirit of Christ, whereas today Mrs. Eddy as a woman brought out the spiritual idea, and therefore not a person, not a mortal. She brought to birth the spiritual idea of Christ science and not of Christ Jesus. So this is the great difference between the demonstration of the 5,000-year period in the Bible, which started out with Jesus, and the 6,000 and 7,000 period that we witness today, in which age really the woman of the apocalypse is the central figure, and no more Jesus is the central figure, that adapted to our age. Really, we must give birth to the science of Christ, and not birth to a human baby, a material person, a material mortal. But because Jesus had that dual nature, he was a great example for us who also partake of that dual nature. We also are material, bodily, corporeal, and on the other side we have a spiritual sense and can culture spiritual sense and can partake as much as we realize it of the Spirit of God, so that he was an example of the highest degree how to work out that dualistic sense. And so he became the way shower. If at that time Mary would have brought forth her ideal as a spiritual idea, we would never have had a Jesus. We would never had an exemplar that would show how to work out a material condition through spiritual qualities. So this was the reason that he was not the way itself, the Christ is the way, but he was the way shower, and therefore was doing something for all mankind for the first time, that he began to teach us and show us by example how to resurrect oneself out of a material sense of existence into a spiritual sense of being. So Jesus was a great adventurer, so to say. He explored the way for us. He was a great explorer that said, nobody has yet gone that way. I'm exploring a problem that nobody has yet seen, nobody has given example for it, nobody has proven it up to now. I have set before me a task that is unique, that is new, but that would be really an example for the whole world and therefore would save the whole world and not only himself. That's why his contribution was not just individual, but it was collective, as we will see. So Mrs. Eddy said that Jesus' mission was both individual and collective. He had to work it out for himself, but also, if he was successful, to set an example for the whole world, for all men. Jesus mapped out the path for others. That was his mission on this world, to map out the path for others so that others could follow him, could pick up the rules and the laws that he exemplified and could use it too. She says that Jesus marked the way for all men. Can you see? There are all statements always repeating that Jesus did it not only for himself, but that it was a collective demonstration, that he did it also for us, for all men. Jesus' consummate example was for the salvation of us all, and that Jesus' resurrection was also the disciples' resurrection. They too received through his example a higher understanding of life. So we have here another big point to see right through, that Jesus did was the way shower, giving us the example how to do it. But he also said something else which we have to remember, namely that is point 16, that there is no other way. We like to find another way because we don't like to go through tribulation. We don't like to lay down the mortal sense of things. We don't like to give up the material sense of things. Therefore, we think, isn't there another way? Isn't there another way where I get around this cup, where I get around really the sacramental Eucharist, and which gives me a much better and easier way into heaven? But the chapter now makes it clear that there is only one way, and that is the scientific way of the Christ. We cannot choose for ourselves. We cannot choose the way we like it. You know, there are not 1,000 ways to Rome. There is only one way to Rome, and that is science. Every other way is a way of suffering, of experience, of faith, of blind faith, of belief, of human opinion and human consideration and conception. There is only one way, and that's the way of science. If that would not be so, there would be no reason to have a science at all. If in mathematics we can use any old ways of working out the problem, then there would be no science of mathematics. If mathematics is a science, the moment it is science, it says, this is the way. This is the only possible law. This is that which brings you to the right result. So we must work out our salvation in the way that Jesus taught it. And naturally would like to find other ways than that which Jesus taught us, because we can always see the example of Jesus, and that is not only that he just went through his life singing and harping and enjoying and laughing and so on. He was very often very downcast. He was doubting. He was in a situation where he wondered, will I do it? Will I achieve it? Will my mission be fulfilled? He had to carry all the burden of the persecutors, of those that betrayed him. He had to bear all that, so it wasn't just an easy way, and we don't like to go that way. But Mrs. Eddy says there is no other way. There is no other way to the spiritual than to lay down the material. It's as simple as that. Naturally, the more we are willing and the more we accept that it is right to lay down the mortal concept, the more that way will be not burdened, the more that way will be easier, though we know that naturally the universal claim of materiality, the universal claim of corporeality, the universal claim of accident, sin, disease, weighs on each one of us. We know that we are born that way, we are educated that way, we are living under the influence of that whole mortal mind atmosphere, and therefore we know we have to do something about it. We can't just close our eyes to it and say, I'm not there. You know that nice joke they have about Christian Scientists, the Christian Scientist that had to go to hell instead that he came into heaven, and they asked him, well, why are you in hell? And the Christian Scientist answered, I'm not there. So this is more or less the attitude that many Christian Scientists take. They say, I have not to work out the problem. They go out from being and say that those wonderful absolute statement that God and man is one and eternally have been one and eternally were perfect. That's all true, but it's not demonstrable until we have gone the ascending way of prayer and atonement and Eucharist and marriage and have touched then the fourth chapter of science versus spiritualism. Up to that point, we really have to do what Jesus asks us to do, what Mrs. Eddy presents here. We have to take the bull by the horn and show that it has no power. Point 17 brings out what we have already pointed out and discussed, that the way is no path of flowers. You know, we say we want to be true to Mrs. Eddy, we want to be obedient to Mrs. Eddy. I'm a very faithful student of Christian Science. I don't deviate from Christian Science. But the question is if we really take that 100% as true. That when the path is not the path of flowers, if then we really accept Mrs. Eddy's teaching as consistent, that we accept that teaching as being that to which we have to submit ourselves, or if we say, well, I don't like that way. I try to shun it, to go around it, but if we are honest, we say to ourselves, I take the whole teaching of the textbook as that which concerns us, and that whole teaching says here, for instance, again, I just enumerate those terms that Mrs. Eddy uses here in the text just to impress our consciousness with it, that path that he shows and said, follow me, is not the path of flowers, that there will be thorns on the way, and that we walk on that way with bleeding footsteps, with persecution, with the suffering of the just for the unjust, that is necessary, that we suffer for the unjust, though we are just, that it is a way full of trials and ordeals, that we have to endure indignities and human brutality, and also receive indignities. That really Jesus was despised, and we have to take that on us too, that we go along the way of science and the idea of science, and the more we pioneer in the unfoldment of the idea of science, the more naturally we will endure the same treatment as Jesus endured. We will be despised and rejected of men. It will be said of us that we are a glutton, a friend of the impure, and Beelzebub is his patron, that he is a friend of the publicans and sinners and the winebibber, and so on and so on. Can you see that this has to be faced and not say, well, I don't like it. We have to like it, to rejoice in tribulation. We have really to take up the challenge and say, I'm going to handle it, I'm going to show that my unity with truth and love is bigger than any opposition. So Jesus had a life full of struggles. For instance, again, I just read it through to show a picture of Jesus full of struggles. It isn't a picture that we teach the little kiddies in the Sunday school with nice pictures and so on, with Jesus putting their hand on the head of the little children and blessing them. We get quite a different, a more realistic picture of Jesus when we go through the chapter on Atonement and Eucharist and see that he was forsaken by all but a few, that he had his struggles in Gethsemane and on Calvary, that he had bitter experiences, that the Passover was a mournful occasion, that he was the man of sorrows, not of joys, that Gethsemane was a night of gloom and glory, that the pangs of neglect and bigoted ignorance smote him sorely, that he was working in speechless agony, exploring the way. He was struggling in voiceless agony. He had the sweat of agony on his face. His last human yearning was not gratified. He had only to suffer mockery, desertion, torture. The burden of that hour was terrible, beyond human conception. It was not just a little bit that terrible situation, it was beyond human conception. The distrust of mortal minds, disbelieving the purpose on his mission, was terrible. He had the world's hatred on him. The world's hatred for truth and love was projected on him as a person. And this dread added the drop of gall to his cup. What a picture. Can you see the picture? Or do we see always Jesus, has he just happily walked through the country healing? Here on the right side, somebody healing. There, somebody on the left-hand side, talking to the multitudes, delivering wonderful sermons to the crowd, all people hailing and standing in awe before him. Is that the picture of Jesus that we entertain? Or isn't there another picture? Actually, that first picture I painted is not in Atonement and Eucharist. Only the other picture is in the chapter of Atonement and Eucharist, the Jesus that was misunderstood.